Good, and yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. I was saying before you called in how complex of a news cycle we have in front of us. It's really interesting what's going
on.
Yeah,
it's interesting, isn't it? It's fun. It's not boring.
No.
Like it has been from time to time over the last 8 years.
Right.
I feel feel a lot better about where we're headed, even though it's more complex, it's more difficult, it's heavier lifting, but it's things are changing. That's a good thing.
Well, let's start with Obamacare, Senator. Right now, mm-hmm. the negotiations are really centered in the House. They've got to get to that majority. You got to be able to please enough of the Freedom Caucus and the moderate Republicans in order to get to that point. And then they've got to worry about having enough votes in the Senate and getting votes from Rand Paul, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, guys like that may be a little bit difficult as well. So kind of size it all up for us.
Well, it's actually a little more complex than that, even. In the Senate, it isn't just a matter of getting those votes. In addition to that, our rules, the rules of the Senate, require a 60-vote margin on anything, not 50 of the 100, but 60 of the 100, unless you can squeeze it into a very narrow path that's called budget reconciliation.
Right.
And by now, I've lost half your listeners, but budget reconciliation is simply a matter by which you can pass with 51 votes what you need to do in order to balance things out.
Yeah.
And so, and the rules are, you couldn't repeal all of Obamacare under budget reconciliation. So that means at least part of it would survive, but we'd be able to do the best we could do, because we're going to get no Democrats on this. They have sworn an oath that they will not help us in any regard to undo this. So that's the challenge. Now, having said that, you know, I walk down the halls and they come running up, "Oh, Senator, you know, the House is having such trouble getting all these votes, and so-and-so says this, and so-and-so." I said, look, this is how legislation is done. You know, you don't just sit down at a table and say, okay, we're going to do this, this, and this. Everybody says, okay. This is a give-and-take proposition with people getting angry, people getting happy, people getting what they want, people getting part of what they want. This is just the way a democracy works. It's messy. It isn't pretty. The old saying about if you like sausage or the law, you don't want to see either one being made is a very
sure,
very accurate metaphor. But we're working through this thing, and the people get criticized for this, that, and everything. It's just the way legislation goes. So we'll see what happens at the end of the day, and if they don't get the votes to do it, I'll be surprised if they just throw in the towel and give up and move on to tax reform. I think there's going to be continued negotiations to try to break through this. Because look, I understand the purists. I'm a purist myself. Unfortunately, pragmatism takes over when you have to govern.
Yeah.
And you want a pure bill that is hardcore right wing conservative, but would you rather have half a loaf of bread or none of the loaf of bread and starve? You know,
right.
I mean,
and
you know, the other point is I've argued with the guys you've mentioned, and that is, you know, a no vote on this is a vote for Obamacare. And they said, that's not true. I said, of course it's true. Here you got a chance to repeal Obamacare, or at least a good chunk of it, and you're saying no. So if you say no, that maintains Obamacare just as Barack Obama wanted it in place. Do you want that? Well, nobody wants that. We don't want that.
So, and let's go back to half a loaf for just a minute. It sounds to me like you're going to vote for this because it does at least dismantle a part of Obamacare. But how much of the loaf is it for you?
Well, actually, I think it's going to be pretty substantial, because it actually is not just legislation. It's also the regulatory side of this thing, which has already been, we've already started dismantling it on the regulatory side. The percentage that you actually get here, I think I'm going to leave that to the experts to figure that out at the end. But look, I said all along, you put in front of me a bill that takes one comma out of the 3,000 pages of legislation that he passed, I'm in. I'm voting for it.
Yeah.
You know? But having said that, I've also got some red lines. I mean, and part of the original language they were talking about said it was blurry as to whether or not the Hyde language would remain. The Hyde language is language that says you can't use U.S. tax dollars to perform abortions. That's a red line for me. I can't cross that. And that's a red line for lots and lots and lots of people up there. That's not even going to be considered doing something like that. So.
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, sometimes it's really hard to drill down to the actual truth here. When the CBO numbers came out, the big narrative, at least for the Democrats, was 24 million people will lose their coverage, almost as if the federal government was going to break into people's homes in the middle of the night and rip away their insurance coverage. But in reality, we found a lot of those people will just simply choose to not buy insurance because it doesn't fit them. I mean, it's not.
Well,
like,
and you're not forced to. You're not forced.
Yes,
to. You don't have a government that's got a gun to your head. But you know, they pulled the same thing on me on the media, national media camp. Said, well, Senator, are you comfortable with have these people not losing their insurance? I said, look, I didn't vote for it in the first place. How come you're not after me? Because I voted no on Obamacare in the first place.
Yeah.
I voted not to put those people on. So, you know, I mean, this is a typical situation where the government does something and then people say, okay, the government did it. Now we must rely on government forever into the future. I tell the high school kids when I talk to them, do not rely on the government to take care of you. Take care of yourself. Plan for yourself. Do things for yourself. If you rely on the government, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah. Well, and you're fighting now against this expectation, thanks to people like Bernie Sanders, that, well, health care is a right. Well, it sounds great. It sounds fantastic. But it gets really problematic when you look at the actual implications of that.
Well, you know, I mean, there are no such rights in the Constitution. The Constitution is pretty clear as to what our rights are, but they're not. They have nothing to do with welfare. The founding fathers put nothing in there about rights for any material things. They gave us rights for speech and for assembly and religion, but nobody said that you have the right to get food, or you have the right to a house, or you have a right to transportation or medical care or anything else.
Yeah.
So, you're right. And expectations do get raised by people who are dogmatic and populist, telling the people that they're entitled to have the government provide everything for them, just like it is in Europe today.
Yeah. All right, let's move to another. This is probably going to be a pretty quick topic because I think there's a pretty good consensus here. Neil Gorsuch was in the hot seat this week for his Supreme Court justice nomination hearings, and by most accounts, even a lot of people on the left said Democrats didn't lay a glove on him. He absolutely knocked it out of the park, and I would assume you agree with that assessment.
Well, there's no question about that, and even Democrats agree with that. But they go back to, well, yes, but you know, they've got he was appointed by Donald Trump, and therefore he's not qualified. Or, well, look, you guys wouldn't appoint, or you guys wouldn't confirm our guy in the last year of the last seven months of the Obama administration. Therefore, we're not going to do this. So, but you couldn't find a better person to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, given his history and the hundreds and hundreds of decisions he's written. They dug down into those decisions. They were quoting stuff that he'd written when he was in high school, for crying out loud, you know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that bad for a high school kid. So anyway. He's going to get confirmed. We owe this to the American people. We're going to get it done, period.
Yeah. Well, and let's move to the Russia-Trump investigation. Cal and I had a conversation right before the show started, and Cal pointed out to me, I think she's 100% accurate, this story about surveillance, Russian involvement, the wiretap tweet from Donald Trump, it is all so big and murky, and there are so many unknowns that if Cal and I don't understand it, and it's our job to cover the media and to understand these these details. I'm sure the average American out there is having a difficult time as well. And we know Comey was on. He appeared before a committee this week and said there's absolutely no evidence to support Trump's tweet. But yet the New York Times and other media had a story about wiretap data of Trump surrogates. And now Nunes, the House Intelligence Committee guy, came forward and said, well, we do have some evidence that Trump was being surveilled, but it has nothing to do with Russia. Can you make any sense of this for us at all, Senator?
Yeah, I'll try. First of all, I sit on the Intelligence Committee, so it is less murky for me probably than it is for the 330 million people that live in America. But this thing is way, way overblown. And I can tell you that when all is said and done, they are going to find what you're going to have is you're going to have conspiratists trying to weave some facts together, and you're going to have others who say, well, the proof was other than what the report said they were. But there is as far as there's some facts that we know that I can lay out for you that are black and white. First of all, did the Russians attempt, that's the operative word, attempt to interfere in our elections? The answer to that is yes. Now, those of us that work in intel, this came as absolutely no shock to us. Mm-hmm. Of course they did. They always do. They're doing it right now in Germany and in France, but they're going through the electoral process. I was in Austria. They actually, and it isn't covertly, it's overtly. They got a party there that they pump millions of dollars of cash into. This is the Russians' stock and trade. They have a policy, just as we have a policy of hands off of other elections, they have a policy of hands on other elections. They want influence. They want a position on the world stage. They want to be respected. They want to be feared. They want people to notice them. And so how do you do that? You step up and you do these kinds of things, like interfering in elections. And so did they try to do this? Yes. Did they actually interfere? There is zero evidence that they were able to accomplish what they wanted to do as far as interfering in our elections. So that set that fact aside. Okay. All right. Now let's go from there to did any of the Trump people collude with the Russians to try to attempt influence our elections? And the answer to that is there is no evidence that's been put on the table, circumstantial or direct, that points to that fact at all. Okay, now let's go to the next point. Did people from the Trump campaign talk to the Russians? Of course they did, and so did the Clintons. Anybody running for president always talks to the major powers around the world. They always do that. In fact, you recall every candidate made a trip to Israel and talked with the Israelis. They talked to every country. Or if you'd ask me over the last 24 months, how many heads of state have I talked to out of the 200 countries, it would be very substantial. Mm-hmm. And this is just, we're sure. In this business. You have to deal with other countries. So did they talk with them? Of course they talked with them. I would be shocked if they hadn't talked with them or the Chinese or the British or the French or or anyone else. You know, I mean, it's just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, all right. Going back, because the point you said there was no evidence at all that Trump officials colluded with the Russians, there is a new report out just in the last 24 hours or so that Manafort, and this goes back a few years, like 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
The allegation is he actually worked for either Ukrainians or Russians. I read the report. I don't remember what it was. That is what it is. I mean, if he did that, he's got certain things he had to do, namely pay taxes on money he made, report under certain circumstances, report as an agent of a foreign government. That's common and commonly done. This town here in Washington, D.C. is loaded with people that are on the payroll of other governments. I mean, almost every government in the world has, in addition to their diplomatic presence here.
Right.
They also employ people to advise them as to how to handle this issue or how to handle that issue. So that, you know, I don't know what happened there. I don't know what the actual facts were. It's 10 years old. It's got nothing to do with anything that's going on today, I don't think. So that I've kind of set that one aside.
All right. U.S. Senator Jim Risch joining us this morning. Senator, we appreciate your insight and clarity, especially on that final issue. Thank you very much.
Good to talk to you.